News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. The Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman has resigned in protest of an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire between Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Lieberman's resignation significantly weakens Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling coalition government and could bring about an early Israeli election. The defense minister says the ceasefire reached with Gaza's Hamas rulers is a surrender to terrorism. He's demanded a far stronger Israeli response to the most intense round of rocket fire against Israel since a 50-day war in 2014. Lieberman's resignation will go into effect in 48 hours. Netanyahu will take over on an interim basis.
The American Vice President Mike Pence took a hard line Wednesday with Aung San Suu Kyi, the de facto leader of Myanmar. He told her at the ASEAN conference in Singapore that there's no excuse for how Rohingya Muslims are being treated.
This is a tragedy that has touched the hearts of millions of Americans. The violence and persecution by military and vigilantes that resulted in driving 700,000 Rohingya to Bangladesh is without excuse. The arrest and jailing of two journalists last fall was deeply troubling to millions of Americans, and I look forward to speaking with you about the premium that we place on a free and independent press.
Diplomatic efforts are underway to bring an end to the fighting for control of the Red Sea port city of Hodeida in Yemen. The city is under attack by a Saudi-led pro-government coalition that is battling Houthi rebel defenders. Britain said the coalition has agreed to allow rebel casualties to be evacuated. This is VOA News. The United Nations warned Wednesday that days of heavy fighting in parts of central eastern Afghanistan have worsened humanitarian conditions, and it urged warring parties to ensure safe passage for civilians trying to leave the affected districts. The UN Security Council voted unanimously Wednesday to lift sanctions on Eritrea after nearly a decade. The targeted sanctions blocked arms sales to and from Eritrea and placed travel restrictions on senior government and military officials. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis traveled to Texas Wednesday to see the thousands of American troops ordered to the border by President Trump. Thousands of Central American migrants are still on the move through Mexico, headed toward the U.S. border. Meantime, Mexican officials in Tijuana, along the border with California, are struggling to deal with buses carrying hundreds of migrants from Central America. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
These are the first groups from the caravans. Across the border, authorities in the U.S. were putting up razor wire security barriers. On the buses were people like Joshua Vargas from Honduras. He says Mexico has been excellent. We have no complaints about Mexico. The United States remains to be seen. A few dozen of the first migrants to arrive scaled the steel border fence to celebrate, chanting, "Yes, we could." One man dropped over the U.S. side briefly. As border agents watched from a distance, he quickly ran back to the fence. Mexico has offered refuge, asylum, or work visas, but many of these people have their sights set on the U.S.
Testimony has begun in the trial in New York City of the reputed Mexican drug kingpin known by the nickname El Chapo. Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
Prosecutors started their case against Joaquin Guzman, called El Chapo, with a video tour of a tunnel between Mexico and an Arizona warehouse. Retired customs agent Carlos Salazar was the guide, showing off a 50-yard-long tunnel with lights and flooring that eased the transit of cocaine on wheeled carts. A second witness, Jesus Zambada, one of the founders of the Sinaloa drug cartel, described Guzman as one of its leaders. He testified the cartel controlled an airport in Mexico City by bribing officials. The defense claims Guzman is being framed by another drug trafficker.
A congressional advisory panel says the purchase of internet-linked devices made in China leaves the United States vulnerable to security breaches that could put critical infrastructure at risk. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission issued the warning Wednesday in a report focused on the increasing use of the internet in household appliances. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
Thank you. morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Something like a constitutional coup might have taken place in Gabon.
The chair of the Constitutional Court gave the authorization to the vice president to call for the ministerial council, which is not his prerogative.
Paul-Marie Gonjou is the Deputy Executive Secretary of Gabon's main opposition National Union Party. The Nigerian Labour Congress is warning the government not to alter or delay implementation of the recent agreement to increase the minimum wage. Rwanda wants to ask South Africa to arrest and extradite the former chief of staff of Rwandan army. And Cameroon's jailed separatist leaders are due back in court today, Thursday.
If you can abduct somebody, detain that person for a duration of over 10 months and you have no charge against that person deserves to be released unconditionally.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonia Separatist Movement of Cameroon. Niger's government is being sued in the ECOWAS Court of Justice, and Kenya's government is poised to make intersex an official category. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Something like a constitutional coup might have taken place in Gabon, where President Ali Bongo has been hospitalized in Saudi Arabia for over 3 weeks now. Late Wednesday night, the president of the country's constitutional court, Marie Madeleine Mborantsuo, authorized Vice President Maganga Massavu to chair the Ministerial Council, the country's main decision-making body. But legal experts say the Constitutional Court does not have the powers to render such a decision. Paul-Marie Gonjou is Deputy Executive Secretary of Gabon's main opposition National Union Party. He says the court's decision is tantamount to a coup.
The chair of the Constitutional Court gave the authorization to the vice president to call for the ministerial council, which is not his prerogative. To call for the ministerial council, it is only the prerogative of the president. But as the president is not here, the prime minister should have gone to visit the president and get from him the express authorization for the vice president to call for the council. By not doing so, it means that the president is no longer able to do so, and the Constitutional Court has not the right to give this express authorization to the vice president. And frankly, we can just talk about a coup from the Constitutional Court. It's very dangerous. We don't know in which way the country is going.
So what happened to Prime Minister Emmanuel Isoze Ngonde? According to you, he was supposed to call for this ministerial council to sit.
In fact, the Prime Minister went to the Constitutional Court to ask the court to interpret the Constitution, because they are in a situation where they need to make some decisions. They need to sign some decrees. They need to appoint some new laws. And the president, by not being there, the country is blocked. We have to find a solution. The only solution would have been to follow the position of the constitution, which is to appoint the president of Senate as the new president to run the country, because the president is no longer able to do so. But today, the Constitutional Court has made things differently. She modified the constitution to give the authorization to the vice president to run the ministerial council and to make some decisions. We don't know what is going to happen tomorrow and the day after tomorrow and the day on. Every day would be something new until we have a new president.
Paul, I heard you using the word coup. Do you think the chairperson of this ministerial council, Marie Madeleine, do you think she is in favor of creating a vacancy in the absence of the president so that the vice president should take over? Do you think she's in favor of that?
To tell you frankly, we don't know, because everything is changing almost every day. The constitution is saying that if the president is not able to run the country, it's the president of Senate which is appointed to do so. And that's what we want the Constitutional Court to decide, just to follow the Constitution and appoint the President of Senate to be acting President. But today, they just didn't follow the Constitution. They went over by changing the Constitution.
Paul, because of what happened, do you think now President Ali Bongo is in any better condition to come back as President of Gabon?
We're not capable to say that, because if the Constitutional Court is modifying the Constitution, if she gives the authorization to the Vice President to call for the Ministerial Council, for us, it means that Mr. Bongo is not in a good check, and we just don't know what is a real medical condition.
Paul Marie Gonjou is the Deputy Executive Secretary of Gabon's main opposition National Union Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Libreville. Leaders of Cameroon's Jail Ambazonia Separatist Movement are due back in court today, Thursday, their second appearance since they were abducted a year ago in Nigeria and extradited to Cameroon. Today's The court appearance comes as the Cameroon military said it killed at least 30 separatists in 2 days of intense fighting in the turbulent English-speaking region. Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonian Separatist Movement. He says the group demands the unconditional release of its leaders because the government has no charges against them.
If you can abduct somebody, detain that person for a duration of over 10 months and you have no charge against that person deserves to be released unconditionally. That is English law. And I hope the judges would dismiss, for whatever reason, they are being held in detention and give them their freedom unconditionally.
But Chris, the government of Cameroon says that your leaders are considered terrorists, posing a threat to the country of Cameroon.
Our leaders are not terrorists. They are nationalists. If they were terrorists, how would they hold them in detention for 10 months, almost a year, without charging them for what they claim they are? They were abducted in Nigeria. Those who abducted them in Nigeria, transferred them overnight to Cameroon, are the terrorists.
Chris, the Cameroon military says on Wednesday that its forces have killed 30 separatists in 2 days of intense fighting. If this is true, is this a sign that the war is turning against you?
You can never believe a word that comes out of the mouth of any French Cameroon government official. What they are doing is propaganda. French Cameroon government has no pedigree for the truth. Our boys are still waxing stronger. They are still defending our land, defending our territory, and defending our people. And if they thought this war is going to be over soon, they made a mistake.
Are your forces, the separatists, are you targeting mayors in the English-speaking region who you probably consider as not sympathetic to your cause? Because there is a report here that said that the mayor of Unwa, a local council in the region, was killed by your forces.
That report cannot be confirmed, and we are absolutely not targeting any of our own in our own territory. The target are the invading soldiers from French Cameroon who have descended upon our territory and attack and kill and burn our towns and villages indiscriminately. They are the people, our restoration forces, are defending our land and defending our people against. Our own people are safer in our hands. There is absolutely no doubt about that.
President Paul Biya, he has asked your group to lay down your arms, perhaps maybe getting ready for some talks.
Well, I do not understand the authority that Mr. Biya thinks he has to ask us to lay down our arms. First of all, he is not our president, so he has no authority to demand that. Our president is Sisiko, Julius Ayuktabe. Secondly, Mr. Biya declared war. How can the president of another country declare war on another country and then have the guts to tell that country to lay down their arms?
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the Ambazonian Separatist Movement of Cameroon. He was speaking with me from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 15th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Rwanda's Public Prosecution Authority confirmed yesterday, Wednesday, that the government is in the process of finalizing a request to the South African government to arrest and bring back to Rwanda the former chief of staff of the Rwandan army, General Faustin Kayumba Nyamwasa, who is in exile in South Africa. He is wanted by the Rwandan government for what the government calls escaping justice. His presence in South Africa has led to deteriorating relations between Kigali and Pretoria. Eugene Wiwimana has more from Kigali.
General Prosecutor Jean Bosco Mutangana said the dossier to arrest those he calls terrorists who sought exile in South Africa and other countries is being prepared. He said they include General Faustin Kayumba Nyamwasa, who fled to South Africa from India on 28 February 2010. Mutangana says the request for the various countries to extradite the so-called terrorist is in high gear. It is no secret. We follow them and others who destabilize the countries east. We decided to trace them and bring them to court. We are working diplomatically with the countries they sought exile in. Kayumba was convicted in absentia by the Rwanda Military High Court on 14th January 2011 and sentenced to 24 years in prison for charges that included forming a terrorist group, threatening state security and undermining public order, among others. Kennedy Gihana, Kayumba's lawyer, told VOA that all charges against his client are fabricated. Rwanda National Congress has never been a terror organization because it doesn't possess firearms. Kayumba is a refugee. Unless the Rwanda's prosecution charges him of being a refugee about those crimes that Rwanda is charging General Kayumba with. In Rwanda, it's not surprising to be called an enemy when you don't think the same way as President Kagame. Relations between Kigali and Pretoria have soared. South Africa accepted to host General Kayumba Nyamwasa and Colonel Patrick Alegeya, the former Rwanda head of intelligence. But the two leaders agreed recently ease tensions in their relations after South African President Cyril Ramaphosa met with his Rwandan counterpart Paul Kagame in Kigali for an extraordinary summit on the African Continental Free Trade Area. They both ordered their foreign affairs ministers to bend down on the diplomatic relations. However, Rwanda and South Africa have no extradition treaty. Law experts say if General Nyamwasa is to ever be extradited to Rwanda, it would be the intervention of Interpol. Kayumba Nyamwasa is the first vice coordinator of the Rwanda National Congress, or RNC, the party that Rwanda accuses of organizing terror attacks in Kigali. Apart from being a friend to President Paul Kagame, General Faustin Kayumba Nyamwasa has been the chief of staff of the Rwandan army from 1998 to 2002, and served as Rwanda's ambassador to India between 2004 and 2010. From India, he fled to South Africa, where he was even allegedly shot. He said the effort to extradite him is for political reasons. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali.
The Nigerian Labour Congress is warning the government not to alter or delay implementation of the recent agreement to increase the minimum wage from $50 to $82 per month. The Labour movement says it is displeased with Information Minister Lai Mohammed's recent statement that the government has not agreed to the increase. This after government supporters complained that Labour's actions are aimed at turning voters against the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari ahead of February's presidential election. Chris Uyo is the Deputy General Secretary of the Nigerian Labour Congress.
Although that came from our counterpart, the Tuesday, but the timeline, I think, is something which we also have to consider.
Is any member of your group suspicious of any moves by the government to truncate or delay it?
Well, we have no cause to think about that. I think that came from the Trade Union Congress, who had their neck and they had to make a pronouncement.
But so far, what is the status of the agreement that you signed with government, and have you gotten any assurances of its implementation soon?
No, we have not gotten a response from the government, but we believe that the president will keep his word. and ensure that the minimum wage is sent to the National Assembly as soon as possible, as you promised.
Talking about the timing, how soon do you think this will be implemented once it's sent to the National Assembly? And are you aware of any moves by the presidency to send it there to begin the process?
We have no indication so far, though the body language of some of the ministers in the government are giving competing signals. But we are assured that the president will do the needful and ensure that the minimum wage is implemented as soon as possible.
Did the government give any assurances as to when it plans to begin implementing this 30,000 naira a month minimum wage?
There was no agreement on that, but we want to go by the president's word that he will do what is necessary. Because the implication of not doing what is necessary is very dire, you know, for the country, especially at this time. I think the Labour has followed all the processes necessary to get this thing done. We have been very patient and responsible organization, and we expect that the government itself will also be responsible in doing its own part.
You spoke about conflicting signals from some of the officials of the government. What are they, and how are you engaging the government to resolve this?
We really have no business with the Minister for Information, who was saying that the government did not accept that 30,000 minimum wage. But that was the agreement that was given to the president, and the president did not say anything contrary. So we just have no business with him. We believe that he was just out of tune.
But some people are saying that it appears that the Labour blackmailed the government into signing the 30,000 minimum wage because of threats that it could create chaos, lead to less productivity of strikes and protests and demonstrations, knowing that the elections are just around the corner in February.
Well, that is not true. The minimum wage negotiation was very transparent, was very open, and the principles were adhered to. So any talk about blackmail or pressure is out of place.
Chris Uyot is the Deputy General Secretary of the Nigerian Labour Congress. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from Abuja. Four extended families representing hundreds of people in Niger are bringing a lawsuit to the ECOWAS Court of Justice, accusing the Nigerian government of expelling them from their lands in the Gontu-Yena Valley of the capital Niamey. A Nigerian developer is now building a luxury hotel on the land, and the former residents say theft has caused them to lose their livelihoods and devastated their lives. Jonathan Kaufman is with Advocates for Community Alternatives.
Gontu-Yena is an agricultural valley. It's beautiful, covered with vegetable gardens. But a few years back, they were suddenly informed that they were being kicked out of their land to build a luxury hotel by a Nigerian hotel company called Somerset Continental. And they said, "We can't be kicked out. This is our land. We've always been here. The government has recognized this is our land." And then the government proceeded to go through a crazy series of bureaucratic maneuvers to cancel their land rights and eventually deny that they'd ever even existed, and expelled them by force of arms. And these people are now trying to assert their rights and get back their land, or at least some assistance to rebuild their lives.
What are some of the main obstacles facing them when it comes to winning the lawsuit?
I'll tell you what happened when they tried to use the formal Niger system, and that will give you a sense of what they're up against. They, unlike most people who lose their land, actually were able to find a lawyer, and they first protested when they found out that their land was being given to someone else. Then the government said, "Okay, well, then we're just going to transfer your rights from yourself to these guys." And they said, that's not legal. So then the government issued a piece of paper that said, "Your land rights have been revoked." At this point, they went to court themselves and they said, "Let's stop. If there's any work that's being done on the site, postpone that while we work out legally how this should go." And actually, an appellate court in Niger issued a stop work order and said, "Somerset Continental, do not do anything on this site." But while that stop work order was in force and pending, the company sent in bulldozers escorted by military and armed forces who expelled all of the local residents at the point of a gun. The next stage was they filed a lawsuit and said, "That was illegal. You can't do that when there's a stop work order and when we have land rights. And at that point, suddenly the government produced for the first time after 3 years of fighting a so-called document that said that actually all of the land in question had been taken by the government, by the French colonial government in 1936. And that it hadn't belonged to the people since 1936, and it was the government's to do whatever they wanted with.
Are there very specific obstacles when it comes to the legal framework was kind of made up by the French? It clashes with the customary and traditional land-owning legal framework.
You know, that's definitely an issue, and you're completely right that the kind of modern land rights usually don't look much like the way customarily people used land, which might have been, you know, in a collective way, or maybe they only used land in seasonal ways and that kind of a thing. But actually, in Niger's case, you've got a pretty adaptive legal system on paper that recognizes customary land rights.
That was Jonathan Kaufman of Advocates for Community Alternatives. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Niger's capital, Niamey. Kenya outlaws homosexuality, considering it a crime against nature, punishable by up to 14 years in prison. But authorities are more supportive of Kenyans who are born with both or ambiguous sex organs, called intersex people. A government task force formed last year has been asked to make recommendations for laws and policies to protect intersex people from discrimination and hate. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
Born 29 years ago as Ruth Muihaki, Ryan Murori faced stigma and abuse and attempted suicide 3 times before taking on his new identity as a man. Ryan says his bad memories started at the age of 5.
I'm not attracted to any girls' games. So my life had been all alone. I was all alone without friends, without interacting with boys, and the same time with girls. Until when now I get the age of puberty. That's where the things turns aloud to me. Like, all my expectation was in vain. Like, maybe I expected to grow like a normal girl, you know, to have breasts, to have hips and all that. But that never happens. Instead, I started becoming masculine.
Kenyan Senator Isaac Mwaura has asked his colleagues in parliament to pass a motion signaling support for intersex people.
When I started out, we didn't know the right terminology. Because if you look at my motion, it is gender identity disorder. And when I was told about the issue of intersex, I was a bit hesitant because the only time I had heard about intersex people was in relation to LGBT. So LGBTI, and you know, it's an anathema to discuss those things in this country.
A 2009 birth of a baby with ambiguous genitalia at a Nairobi hospital forced the issue of intersex people into the courts. Hospital staff put a question mark next to the box designating the gender, and the child was not given a birth certificate. In 2014, a court ordered the government to issue a birth certificate to the child and ordered the Attorney General to name a task force that will develop policies for support of intersex persons.
That was Rael Ombuo reporting from Nairobi, Kenya. And that's it for this Thursday, November 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, new Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is pushing through reforms, including tackling economic mismanagement, fighting corruption, and human rights abuses. An in-depth discussion on Ethiopia's new era on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.